Hello, my name's Jeremy Gordon and welcome to the Funds Fanatic Show. It's very likely come to your attention that energy prices have been going up a lot. Oil, natural gas, and in the UK, our utility bills. As such, I'm particularly pleased to be joined on the podcast today by John Forster, who manages Impax's flagship £1.4 billion Environmental Markets Investment Trust. Impax, where John has been working since his early days in 2000, is a pioneer in environmental or ecological investing. Clearly, that's a very necessary growth area as we tried to slow climate change, but if it was a lonely furrow in 2000, it's certainly not anymore, and Impax has repeatedly warned that the rush of money into this area is making their job as investors more difficult. John, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Thank you for coming on. Well, maybe you can start by telling us about what you do. It impacts environmental markets. What is it in a nutshell?
Great. Okay, thanks. So Impax Environmental Markets is a fund that aims to give investors exposure to growth in the markets for the cleaner and more efficient delivery of basic services in the areas of energy, water, food, and waste. It's a global fund investing in pure play companies operating across a whole range of environmental markets. So new energy, clean and efficient transportation, sustainable food, water, circular economy, smart environment. You can get an idea of the rich diversity of the opportunity set. Otherwise, I'd just say we're mainly focused on growth and performance. That's our focus. But in addition to that, an investment in the fund does deliver a significant net environmental benefit.
Okay. And so, well, you've said there, but to be clear, this isn't just about renewable energy, as might spring to some people's minds.
No, definitely not. I mean, in the early days, environmental markets were dominated by alternative energy, but now, it's a much richer, more diverse opportunity set. So energy, water, food, waste, that kind of range of opportunities.
Yeah. And in terms of your basic pitch to investors, I suppose, why invest directly in this space?
Well, the main reason to invest is performance, right? We strongly believe that in order to address some of the challenges in the global economy around resource efficiency, addressing challenges like climate change, pollution, that the companies that are providing the solution to these problems will grow faster than the global economy, and that faster growth would translate into better performance compared to global equities. So that's the main reason to invest, as far as we're concerned. But as I said, you can attribute a net environmental benefit to investment in the fund. So I do think where people put their capital to work makes a difference in the world. We are participating in fundraisings, primary fundraisings that fund growth in these businesses. We are engaging with these companies to help them get better, to measure their environmental footprint, set targets and look to reduce their water use and environmental footprint. So from a lot of different angles, an investment has good benefits, both financial and non-financial.
Mm. Can I just push you on that point a bit about investing in the fund having a net environmental benefit? I suppose, I sometimes wonder for an equity fund as you are, public equities, how does it actually kind of benefit the companies, you buying their shares? How does it speed up some of those positive developments?
Well, you can, I guess it's debatable owning secondary shares. What difference does that make? But I'd say there is a case for saying that, your ownership stake in a company gives you some kind of entitlement to claim, some of the benefits that company is providing to the broader economy. So, secondary ownership is a bit more limited, which is why, participating in fundraisings, engaging with companies to provide a bigger benefit is also kind of squarely within our remit.
Yeah.
And does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. I mean, during the, particularly in the early stages of the coronavirus pandemic, we saw more companies, coming to raise equity on secondary markets.
you know, did you support some of your companies during fundraisers in the earlier stages of the pandemic, or?
So I think in the early stages of the pandemic, we were very focused on balance sheet integrity and making sure that our companies could make it through. And we always concentrate on well-capitalized businesses that have, you know, strong balance sheets. So I don't think there was a necessity to participate in any emergency fundraisings, but, you know, we're fairly significant shareholders on the register of some of our companies, and we're standing ready to participate as required.
Okay. Well, you're saying the main reason to invest is about performance, and I, if I will just read out some figures, kind of bearing out that you have been doing a good job on that front. So, Impact's environmental markets over 10 years has delivered about 412% return to shareholders, which is far in advance of about 145% for the MSCI World. Now, this is the kind of flagship trust at Impacts. But you also run an open-ended fund. Is that right, John? And can you just kind of tell us who your colleagues are working on it with you?
Yes, that's right. So Impacts Environmental Markets is part of what we call the specialist strategy, which invests globally across the full range of environmental markets in pure play, small and mid-cap companies. We've got a total of $4 billion of assets in the strategy. And the two biggest vehicles are Impacts Environmental Markets, which is around £1.4 billion, and then the open-ended variant, Impacts Environmental Markets Ireland, which is about £1 billion. So they're all run to the same set of targets, and it's, you know, it's the same underlying product, if you like. So that's the product. In terms of people, Bruce Jenkin-Jones and myself have been working together for 20 years in Impacts from the inception of the strategy. We were recently joined by Fotis Hadjimichalikis as a portfolio manager for the trust. He's been at Impacts for, I think, 7 years now and has done a fantastic job on researching new ideas for the portfolio, had really kind of grown into, you know, his understanding of the portfolio overall. And so we felt it was time to recognize that contribution and bring him on as a portfolio manager.
Okay. And is there an element of planning for the future in that or not so much?
I think it's, you know, recognizing the contribution that he was already making and kind of bringing him you know, up to speed on that. So that was the main reason for the change.
Okay. Well, before we kind of circle back to talk about the portfolio in a bit more detail, as I alluded to in the intro, this is a topical area. There's been a lot of debate about whether Russia, of course, a major fossil fuel supplier invading Ukraine, could speed up the energy transition. What's your take on that?
I think it's definitely the case that the tragic events unfolding in Ukraine are going to change the face of energy in global markets, and it is definitely going to speed up the transition. It's been interesting to see that in the early days of the crisis, energy was not at all on the agenda because of the mutual reliance between Russia and Europe in particular. Europe gets about 40% of its gas from Russia, and so I think in the early stages it was felt that this mutual reliance and dependency meant that it couldn't be on the agenda for change. But the events that have been unfolding mean that that is changing very quickly. So you've probably seen the Repower EU objective is to reduce our reliance on Russian gas by 2/3 by the end of 2022 and to take it completely out of the mix by 2030. So this is a massive upheaval and transition to be made. It's definitely going to be complicated in terms of how do you do that, how do you achieve that. But it's, you know, it's going to have a number of building blocks. You know, choosing and finding alternative sources of gas. There's probably going to be more nuclear, but also importantly for us, there's going to be an increased opportunity both for renewable energy and energy efficiency. So the plan's talking about 80 gigawatts of incremental renewables by 2030 versus the prior plan, and an acceleration of energy efficiency initiatives across the board as well. So, you know, it's another upheaval where the trust is on the kind of winning or kind of beneficiary side, providing the solutions.
And well, I'm definitely keen to talk more in a bit about those opportunities it's going to create for you. There have been people saying for a long time that they think the energy transition is going to be hugely inflationary, and part of what we're seeing here already is the energy majors have already slightly curtailed their capex. They're spending a bit less on getting oil out the ground, but as a society, we haven't really changed our behaviour. We haven't really changed the demand side of the picture hasn't changed. What do you think about that and this kind of inflation question around energy?
So the first thing I say is I'm not an oil and gas expert.
No, well, neither am I, is the way I phrase my question, probably let you know.
But it is something that we've looked at, and obviously, investors have been asking our opinion on it as well. So, is it inflationary? I think I'd say, not necessarily in the long term, although it is likely to cause a lot of volatility in energy prices on the way through. So if you kind of unpack it on the demand side of things, demand is going to moderate. The International Energy Agency, for example, is talking peak oil somewhere between the mid-20s and the mid-30s, 2030s, depending on government intervention. So, given everything we've just talked about in Russia and Ukraine, I think it's reasonable to assume, maybe the earlier rather than the later portion of that time horizon. So as the electrification of vehicles accelerates and as we get through peak oil demand, as demand comes off, the price can be very sensitive to that kind of marginal demand. So that's the outlook for the demand side of things. And then on supply, my understanding anyway is that we have been through a long and deep down cycle in capex and investments in oil and gas. My understanding is that we're turning a bit of a corner in there, and I think the other thing I'd say is that a substantial portion of oil supply comes from the national oil companies that are owned by governments that rely on it for tax revenues. So they're low cost, but also fairly price inelastic. So they're probably going to keep on pumping. And so I think the supply side we would expect to be robust and in the face of demand that's going to be moderating. So, I think there's reasons to believe that that the oil price may not sustain at a very high level. But the question is, what are we replacing it with? And is that more expensive, right? And I think the message is that the cost of technology in low carbon energy and renewables has come down a long way. So renewables, in a lot of cases, is competing on a completely unsubsidized basis and can be the cheapest power available. So it doesn't have to be inflationary necessarily.
Yeah, well, that sounds like good news to me. Maybe I can just quickly take you back to 20 years ago when you and Bruce started managing this strategy, at a time when I think I'm right in saying oil companies were among the most valuable companies in the world still in about 2000. When you first started talking about this kind of investing to people, what did they think?
It's funny trying to think back 20 years. I think it was trying to remember that far back at this stage of the game. But I think in 2002, when the trust launched, we would admit it was very early days in environmental markets. They were small niche markets that were just starting to emerge and grow. We had a very small universe of 250 companies. It was very dominated by alternative energy. They were highly speculative. A lot of them were unprofitable. It was quite racy, to use a technical term. But I think, what investors liked, they obviously liked the fact that Impax is a specialist in this area and this is all we do all day, every day. They could see the government targets starting to come into place, the technologies and the business models starting to firm up. So I think investors were intrigued and willing to give us a shot. So that was That's how it looked then. Obviously, it's come quite a long way since.
It has indeed. Well, I'm fast forward today, and almost every big asset manager in the last few years will have launched their own version of a climate fund or an energy transition fund or something like that. And at Impax, as you say, this is your bread and butter, this wider universe. And you have warned that the amount of cash basically flowing into this space is almost starting to outstrip opportunities. What are your latest thoughts on that and the risks there?
I wouldn't say it's outstripping the opportunities, but it makes it even more important to have a diverse opportunity set and to be nimble and to have room to maneuver. So I think, as I said, we've done a lot of work over the years finding new uncorrelated opportunities within environmental markets, which give you new opportunities for growth. The diversification reduces the risk profile, and it just makes for a healthier portfolio. So our opportunity set has grown out of all proportion. The 250 companies we talked about before has grown to 1,300. We are three or four sectors when we first started investing. We've now got 38 different environmental subsectors we're investing in. So I think that the size of the universe, the diversity of the opportunity set, is what helps us get the good growth without the same amount of risk, and it helps us manage these valuation hotspots that our markets are prone to.
Okay, and I suppose, well, looking today broadly, what markets that you look at are offering the best opportunities, and which you feel, where are you still a bit worried about valuation?
Yeah, I think in terms of valuation, the areas that are exposed to this drive towards net zero have been where most of the challenge has been. So renewable energy and parts of the energy efficiency arena. So that's where valuations were getting a bit overheated. I think we'd flagged that in the tail end of last year. Obviously, with this great rotation that we're seeing this year out of quality and growth into value, valuations have actually become much more sustainable across the portfolio. So I think the valuation challenge has abated somewhat across our markets. So that's how I feel about valuation now.
So you're feeling
still a
bit
challenge,
sort of
but less
to
than
move
it
again.
Was. Yeah, so that's right.
So you feel like there's a bit more flexibility almost in your universe.
So I think that the valuations across the portfolio are more in line with historical averages. The premium that we have to global equities is still elevated, but justifiable. But at the end of the day, I feel more comfortable about portfolio valuation. And we're finding some great opportunities across our markets. Sorry, over to you.
Oh, well, and you mentioned that with this perhaps speeding up of the energy transition in Europe as a result of the Ukraine war, that's going to create a big kind of upsurge in demand again, maybe in the direct renewables sector. Are you starting to look there a bit more?
We have been finding incremental opportunities in renewable energy. We're particularly focused on the project developers who build, own and operate wind farms and solar parks. We like the value creation but the kind of defensive growth profile of those businesses. And we've been looking for IPPs that bring something different. So that's an area that we have been getting some incremental exposure to. But I think a lot of those names have reacted to the situation in Russia and Ukraine, whereas if you look to the energy efficiency arena, which is going to be another prime beneficiary, we feel that those sectors have reacted less. So there's probably better opportunities in the area of energy efficiency across different verticals.
Okay, just to kind of bring bring to mind, John, the kind of companies and businesses we're talking about here. You know, can you outline, say, a large utility that's developing these renewable assets and a name in the energy efficiency area as well? You know, yes. Who are you investing in and why are you excited?
Okay, so one of the on the renewable IPP side of things, our biggest holding is called EDP Renovaves. The things we like about them are they've got a very good diverse group of assets spread across different jurisdictions. They've got a big business in North America and also across different countries in Europe. They've got a strong track record. They have about 5 gigawatts of capacity under operation at the moment and a strong track record of developing projects. So they've got a aggressive goal to add, I think, 20 gigawatts in the next 4 or 5 years. They've got the pipeline to deliver that. And that's what we're quite excited about is the value creation from that.
Yeah,
so that would be
a
renewable
company
name. Yeah.
This is, thank you, John. This is a Portuguese
it's listed
company,
in Portugal.
It's much more global. Okay, sure.
Yeah, that's
how
right.
How about
exactly
on the energy efficiency side?
On the energy efficiency side, we're present across, there's a whole range of different verticals. So there are areas like in the buildings arena, it would include heat pumps and high efficiency lighting. In the industrial arena, it would include industrial software to facilitate the industrial Internet of Things, which is another energy efficiency story. In the digital infrastructure arena, we have renewable powered high efficiency data centers. We have, you know, power electronics and semiconductors that are also driving efficiency gains in their sectors. So you can see it's quite a rich and diverse seam of opportunity.
Mm.
Do you want to talk about a name? You want a name?
Yeah, what I suppose, yeah. What's your favorite name in that area or a name that you've been adding to?
Well, actually, in the UK arena, there's a couple of names. One, which is probably known to everyone in and around the top 10, is called Spirax Sarco, and they are a steam specialist. So they send in their army of engineers into an industrial setting, help the company understand how to make more efficient use of steam in their manufacturing process, and then they sell them the equipment and the consumables to realize the plan. So if you think, you know, what's going on in Russia, Ukraine, the need to be more efficient with the use of gas and steam is, you know, that's an area that should looks quite attractive to us, basically. So that's what they do. That's a long held company in the portfolio. And then more recently, we participated in a fundraising, actually a primary fundraising, for a group called Discovery, with an IE on the end, and they're a specialist supplier of electrical components that go into a range of industries, but particularly renewable energy, public transportation, and this industrial Internet of Things. So it's that's a more recent addition to the portfolio.
Okay, thanks. And you've said before, I think, that you think changing consumer preferences is going to be an important legacy of COVID that could have an impact on your universe as well. How has that been creating opportunities?
It's been fascinating to watch, I'd say, that consumer preference has really emerged as a new but very potent driver of growth in our markets. I think it originated in the VW Dieselgate scandal, which resulted in everyone, you know, demanding this transition towards electric vehicles, right? So that was maybe the biggest recent upheaval in that side of things. But as we've come out of COVID, there's been a, you know, more additions to the list of demands from consumers. So I think I would highlight natural ingredients as maybe the biggest amongst those. So it's basically making a transition away from synthetic or fossil fuel derived ingredients into more sustainable, natural alternatives. So DSM in the portfolio supplies animal feed made from natural ingredients that increases the uptake of nutrition, reduces emissions, and is very incremental to the industries that it serves. And we have a range of other bio-ingredient, biochemicals businesses that are likewise transitioning industries away from fossil fuel-derived chemicals into a more sustainable alternative.
Okay.
So and that's a couple of examples.
Thank you. And would that apply to, the food that we're consumers are eating as well?
Not always. So some of the bio-ingredient biochemicals companies are going more into industrial processes. So we're not talking about what you're eating.
Yeah.
But, the DSM, the animal feed, those kind of opportunities are probably kind of more food related.
Okay, sure. And, something else I'm keen to talk about is that you invest globally in the portfolio, but Impax also runs a dedicated Asia strategy looking at your Asian environmental markets, although the exposure to Asia in your own portfolio is closer to, say, I think it's about 13% according to the latest fact sheet. What are the opportunities like in Asia at the moment?
We definitely find Asia a very attractive investment opportunity for the trust and across environmental markets. They've got a lot of challenges in that region. There's a lot of catch up on policy and a lot of growth opportunities to be had. We do have, as you said, we've got about 13% exposure. I think I'd say that's meaningful, and it's in line with global equities. And if you think about end market exposure, where the companies are selling to, our exposure is more like 20%, which is again in line with global equities. So it's we've got kind of inline exposure to the Asia Pacific region. We'd like it to be higher, but I think what we've found is that Asia is slightly kind of dominated by larger, more diversified conglomerates, which don't make it to our 50% minimum environmental exposure to be have this pure play designation. So we're definitely working hard with our team on the ground in Hong Kong. We've got good exposure across a range of opportunities like industrial automation. We own Giant, the bike manufacturer, and Indraprastha Gas being a natural gas distribution company over in India that's addressing air quality in the New Delhi area. So there's a rich, diverse group of opportunities.
Okay. And you mentioned the team on the ground in Hong Kong. How about in mainland China? I mean, that's somewhere where we hear about both enormous pollution problems, but actually some progress with renewables and electric vehicles.
I think they've made a lot of progress. So I'd say if you reach back into the 2005, 2010, that kind of arena, the Chinese government had a succession of five-year plans that were targeting more and more environmental markets. So renewables, waste treatment, better water treatment infrastructure, expansion of the rail network. So a lot of that work has happened. And those investments which we did have been realized. So it's definitely still an opportunity, but a lot of the heavy lifting in the traditional industries has already happened. So we've moved on elsewhere.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, John. We've mentioned Spirax Sarco. What about the UK? Can you discuss some of the other opportunities that you see in the UK?
So I think Spirax is the biggest one. We've got about 8% total exposure in UK listed names. But I think Spirax and Discovery are probably the bigger names on that list.
Yeah. Okay. And I suppose, I don't know if you can, I'm not sure this is a question about the portfolio so much, but there has been a bit of disappointment that we, in the UK, maybe we've progress comparatively well with the rollout of renewable energy, but you know, there's a lack of, say, wind turbine manufacturers or big battery companies in the UK. Has that, have you, can you give us any insight into that, or is that a surprise, a disappointment? Or
I'd rather not get too drawn into political statements on on policy. I think, you know, I would say that the complexity of policy in some environmental markets has been maybe an obstacle to growth and confidence in some of these, in some markets. Like if we look at, think about renewables, for example. So, but we do, you know, we still have holdings that are leaders in their space that are based out of the UK. Spirax probably being the, yes, the best example. And, you know, we'll see where we go. You know, the government is looking to encourage a domestic EV supply chain. So let's hope that we can, you know, bring some of this capacity and capability onshore. That would be great.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks. Well, last couple of questions about the portfolio. I suppose you've mentioned that you look for these kind of pure play companies. You don't want it to just be one unit of a company that's really acting in your core markets. Is that what means that, in terms of your exposure, this is kind of more of a mid-cap trust? You're unlikely to invest in truly giant companies.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a history here. I mean, when we first started, these were small niche markets served by small cap companies. You know, now roll forward 20 years, these are, you know, larger mainstream market opportunities that are served by a kind of a, more of a kind of mid and small cap set of companies. So there is, you know, that's why the mid cap bias, but still looking for small cap opportunities. You know, we do have a few names in the portfolio that are more $30-35 billion of market cap. But once it gets into this kind of large cap arena, I think our feeling is that investors can do that themselves. And what they're looking to us for is these smaller, interesting, you know, diversifying holdings that they can't find anywhere else. So that's really what we're focused on.
Okay, well, that's a nice clear message there. I suppose we've talked about valuation in your sectors and some of the challenges there. Now, as the you're not the only London listed investment trust in this space, but you're the largest by a long way and the most prominent, and you do have a long history doing this. And that does mean that as interest in environmental investing has grown, sometimes the shares have moved up to trade a very large premium to the value of the underlying portfolio, the net asset value. Can you kind of comment on that a bit, and what you or the board have been doing about it, really?
It's definitely good question. So obviously, as you say, the interest in environmental markets has been strong. IEM as a long-standing fund has attracted a lot of attention. So the premium that we had been, it traded on average 6% premium in 2021, but there were times when the premium was getting to more into the kind of mid-teens, right? So quite a large premium. The board had a clearly stated policy and preference that the share should trade around NAV in normal market conditions. So we were issuing shares at a premium to manage that premium and satisfy demand. I think we issued just over £150 million worth last year. And, you know, that's kind of the, on the issuance side of things.
That's a lot of shares for the trust to issue in 1 year. But you, the managers as well, or perhaps Impax as a group, were saying maybe that pace of issuance couldn't go on. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Last year's issuance was around 12% of shares outstanding. You know, capacity is an issue in this strategy. We don't want to take on more assets than we can manage and give people the same product that they joined us for. So we've got a limit of 10% issuance in a given year, and we're trying to manage to that. On the, so that's the messaging on issuance.
Okay, but now the premium has come down a bit, hasn't it? Well, particularly in this year's volatility.
It has, yeah. So what we saw when Russia crossed the border into Ukraine was obviously a lot of market upheaval, and the trust went to a small discount of around mid-single digits. So having been issuing a lot of shares at a premium, we were very keen as managers and board to do what we said we would do and stand behind the trust. So we were in the market. We did do a couple of small buybacks in that period of extreme volatility, but it's a key message for investors that they, you know, they don't have to worry about the emergence of a big discount.
Okay, thanks, John. Yeah. Well, I suppose a couple of questions looking more to the future now. For you know, you've mentioned how as you've managed this strategy over the last two decades, your number of end markets and their scope has grown. For environmental investing, what do you think the next frontier might be? You know, in 5 years' time, what might we be talking about as the new opportunities?
I think it's kind of here and now, but the first one would probably be the circular economy. We've kind of touched on it a couple of times, but I think, you know, what does this mean? It touches all parts of the economy. It's about efficient product design. It's about the materials and manufacturing processes that you use. It's about sharing economy business models during the life of a product, and then it's about recovery and recycling at the end. So we've got good exposure across those industries at the moment, but I think it's a concept that's just starting to become embedded in the global economy, and we think there's going to be a lot more opportunities on that side of things going forward. So equipment rental is a more recent addition. Which has been very successful for us. So that's the first one, is circular economy, which is real now, but we think it's got a lot of legs on it. Mm. If you're talking the next frontier, you know, slightly further out, I think carbon capture and storage, and we would also argue hydrogen and hydrogen infrastructure, you know, these are frontier markets that are getting to, you know, more proof of concept and technology, currently very expensive, but with quite a lot of potential. So, you know, we're looking to understand the market opportunity, the strength of the business model. We are focused on profitable businesses. We'd like to see a reasonable valuation we can get our heads around. But, you know, those are definitely areas we're spending time on as well.
Okay, so what once we see what businesses get a bit more established, you might well be investing in those areas too.
Yeah, that's right. And we're doing a lot of research in all of the above.
Very interesting. Well, I suppose that the last question I wanted to ask you, John, was I think it was in 2015, so quite a number of years ago now, the famous Paris Agreement agreed to try to limit man-made global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius and preferably 1.5 degrees. Do you think we're going to make it?
I think we're making good progress towards this goal. And there's been a lot of studies that come out from the International Energy Agency, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So I think the most recent numbers I could see were that the implementation of policies that are currently in effect, that are law, that would leave us with 2.6, 2.7 degrees of climate change by 2100. So that's obviously not enough. Secondly, if all of the 2030 targets were met, so if people translated all their goals into policy and executed, that would get us to 2.4 degrees of temperature change. And if everyone fulfilled their net zero targets and obligations, that might get us to 1.8 degree. So I think, you know, we have to recognize the very substantial efforts of governments and progress that's being made. But I would say we're not quite there yet, in my opinion. And so it's very important what is done in the next 10 years. I think they're going to be pivotal to establishing the trajectory of action and climate change. So it's, you know, I think by far the cheaper long-term option is to act aggressively now rather than have to cope with the consequences later.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, John. A clear message there, I think. That's all we've got time for. So last thing remains to say as well. Thank you very much for joining me on the podcast, and good to learn more about impacts.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. All the best.
Thank you. And last thing to say from me is thank you very much for listening at home, and please look out for more Funds Fanatic Show podcasts soon.